This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined as always by Bradley Chambers. And tonight we have two sponsors for the show, Jam Software, makers of the great Casper Suite for Mac and iOS, and Aerohive, makers of cloud-managed Wi-Fi that keeps our iPads, Macs, and iPhones happy and up and running. Bradley, how are you doing?
Fantastic, fantastic. It is a dreary, dreary day in the eastern U.S. today. The entire coast is getting rain, like basically from New York down to Florida, it's raining.
That sounds about right. I think it's actually spreading all across the Atlantic as well, because it's been the same here today.
But I did get my transporter syncs in, and got both of them.
Oh, right, okay.
So they are up and running. I am testing them now. I am testing them for work, but I'm also writing a review for ChambersDaily.com, just with some notes. And I mean, they're just kind of, you know, the too long didn't read version. It's a really nice device, but I don't know that I would replace it. I'm not willing to uninstall Dropbox just yet. Mm-hmm. But it could be in the future with some software upgrades. So that's the too long didn't read version. But they're really nice devices overall. But we'll got to test it a little bit longer and hammer on it some more with some more 4 GB files.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in that from the point of view of like a real kind of bulk Dropbox-esque kind of thing that's accessible from iOS. I mean, I think we've mentioned this before on the show, but my interest is in putting movies out of iTunes and into something where I can download occasional ones onto my iPad over the air. And I'm interested to see if that use case would work out with that.
Yeah, I think so far it will. My biggest complaint, specifically with the Sync device, and I don't think this is the case with the regular transporters, is that on the Sync, it works very much like Dropbox does with like selective sync. So either the file is or folder is synced locally and also stored on the device, or you can do selective sync where it's no longer on your Mac at all and you don't even see it. I mean, you see the folder, right, and if you try to open it, it actually opens a PDF that says, hey, this is not synced. So the issue with that is there's no way to upload files from the web. So the only way you're going to be able to upload files is to re-enable syncing, drop the file on there, let it sync up, and then turn it off. Or you can mount the device as like a Samba share. But again, I mean, mm-hmm. I just feel like, and I don't know I don't know if it's a technical reason or if it's a marketing reason why there is no, like, they call it the transporter library, where it's, you know, you see it locally in the Finder, but it's only on the transporter. So I don't know, you know, why the sync doesn't support that. I'm trying to get clarification on if that's a technical thing or if that's a marketing thing to help you buy the more expensive devices.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe they have a specific use case in mind for just one of them, but probably hasn't been communicated as well as it could have been.
True. We're Thanksgiving week here in the U.S., so I'm getting ready to eat lots of food and then regret it after the fact.
Oh, I'm sure you won't. I'm sure you would. My daughter at dinner tonight was asking what Americans had for Christmas dinner, and my wife was explaining some things that involved marshmallows, I think. Is that a thing?
Yes. My favorite thing involving marshmallows is like a sweet potato souffle, where you take sweet potatoes and marshmallows, and it's like a big mess of deliciousness. So it's like not a dessert. It's, you know, it's sweet, but it's not a dessert, wow. So you can eat that and, you know, like pie later.
Well, that's what she was describing, and Beth's eyes were like saucers. Just couldn't believe that marshmallows was a thing that you could have during a meal. So I think that's going to be demanded at Christmas in this house as well.
Well, yeah, my son is just old enough to like understand like that, the whole Santa Claus thing. You know, we talked about this last week, but he doesn't quite understand like Christmas is a day and not somewhere you go. So he keeps asking to go to Christmas, and it's like, well, we tell him, it's like, well, buddy,
I want to go to there.
Yeah, I want to go to there. Yeah, from 30 Rock, and we've got presents under the Christmas tree already, and he keeps wanting to open them, and he says there are toys in there. So what are you going to do?
All he knows, he's figured it out.
Yes.
I'm just terrified that George is going
to
pull down our Christmas tree because she's into climbing and everything. So,
That's true.
Babies.
Yes. This is, what's the old joke? This is why daddy drinks, or this is why mommy drinks. It's like,
that's where drinking was invented.
Kids. I'm off this week from work, and it's exhausting. I do not envy my wife.
Yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it?
But before we get rolling, let's thank one of our sponsors for today, Aerohive Networks. They reduce the cost and complexity of today's networks with cloud-managed, and that's the key, cloud-managed, not controlled, Wi-Fi switching and routing solutions for enterprise, medium-sized businesses, including branch offices and teleworkers. Of course, obviously this includes all your education networks. Aerohive's award-winning cooperative control Wi-Fi architecture that works with a private or public cloud. It eliminates costly controllers and eliminates single points of failure. This gives its customers mission-critical reliability with granular security and policy enforcement and the ability to start small and expand without limitations. Had a phone conversation with a potential Aerohive customer yesterday, and that was my pitch to them. Was they had talked to me on Twitter and said, "Hey, can we give you a call?" And so we had a quick phone call, and I said, "Look, you can buy one today and move up to 9,000 tomorrow." And so that's one of the cool things about Aerohive is you don't have to plan for scalability; it just scales. So learn more about them at aerohive.com, AeroHive.com, and we'll have a link to them in the show notes at outofschool.net.
All right, thanks to them for sponsoring the show. So we've got a couple of topics tonight. Bradley, you've brought one, and I've brought one. Yours is both longer and I think more detailed and interesting than mine, but I think we will do a bit of both. I wanted to mention just before that, we kind of been tweeting back and forth this week about this idea of producing this podcast entirely on iOS, and we've been pushing kind of hard on this, and I just wanted to sort of lay down a trailer for future shows, because we're going to talk about this in a couple of weeks' time once we've tested it a little bit more. But I think it's fair to say that we have probably cracked the entire problem of creating a podcast, editing it, writing the show notes, and uploading it, publishing it on the web, all on iOS devices. Would you say that's fair? I think we're just about there.
Yes, you know, we've not done it the entire workflow on one single show. We've kind of done various pieces on various shows, but the hardest thing was the publishing aspect, and it's crazy mm-hmm. that three line iMessage, on Sunday for us kind of solved it. You thinking of one of the tools we could use, and it worked perfectly. And this past week's show was published completely from my iPad, and it could actually be done from an iPhone, which is amazing as well. I never thought that would be possible, but it is. So we've cracked it. So that'll be in a few weeks.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the story of the past few years, isn't it? The things that people said were impossible are no longer impossible in iOS. We've actually have in the past recorded and edited two shows on iOS using Aria, which is a multi-track digital audio workstation for iOS. I think if you want to go back and listen to them, those were shows 54 and 58. I'm doing that from memory, but I think that's right. But those were then transferred over Dropbox to you, and then you posted them through a Mac, through a web upload. But we think we've cracked every part of it, and once we are sure that we have, we will be blogging it, and we'll have a show about it later on. Because, of course, as you know, every podcast eventually becomes about podcasting at some point. So we will cross that barrier in a couple of weeks' time.
But unlike when Hypercritical had its last show about the show Hypercritical, that will not be our last show. So
We should have done the trick about this is going to be the last show, and then it's not.
I think the listeners will know it's the last show when the title is something like "School's in Session," because the show is out of school. So that's how you'll know back just from the title. That's the end.
Okay, so Bradley, what's your topic for tonight?
So one of the things that I've been looking at our school is moving our fifth grade into a one-to-one setting. Mm-hmm. We have about 305 students on campus, and that includes our three-year-olds up through fifth grade. We have three grades up until fourth grade, and then we go to two grades. Like, the class sizes get slightly bigger, and then in fourth and fifth grade, we just have two classrooms. So we are in the kind of early stages of experimentation and brainstorming what this would look like at our school for next fall with our incoming fifth graders. So the question that my headmaster posed to me is, why now? Why are we looking at this now? And I had always kind of said to him, I will really look at this when we can get our books digitally. And of course, we've talked about that in the past, how much a bag of hurt the electronic textbook market is. And then what got me thinking is something you said a few shows ago about And I think you tweeted about it too, how in some ways you're glad that you don't have electronic textbooks, because then the iPad becomes simply just a textbook.
Yeah. It's too valuable to lock up just to read off.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that got me thinking, are we missing something that can enhance our learning environment by waiting on something that might realistically might be a long time before it comes, if ever. Maybe we don't even do books by that time. Mm-hmm. So I began talking to our fifth grade teachers and just and a few parents about the idea, just to get their feel for it. You know, get some feedback on what they thought. Of course, they obviously had concerns, as they probably should, just questions as much as anything. Mm-hmm. How would this look? How would that look? Who would own it? What's the model? And we don't know have all those answers just yet. That's part of what we're doing. But my next step in the process, again, because we are a K 3 through fifth grade, is we want our parents to, when they leave our school to go to a middle school, to think fondly of their time at Brainerd Baptist School. We don't want them to like leave or you know, us do something in fifth grade that impacts them negatively at their next school. And so I've got a pretty good relationship with my counterparts at all of the middle school and high schools. Most of our students go to about four schools in town that they go to that are we don't have any middle school only schools. The rest of them are 6 through 12 schools mainly, and there are a lot of them go to an all boys school, and then there's also an all girls school that's very popular.
Okay.
So I reached out to their IT directors and said, look, here's our plans. What are your plans for next year? How do our plans fit in with your plans? And basically saying, if a parent has an iPad from for our school that they purchase, are you going to tell them when they get to sixth grade that it's no good? Because that's what we don't want.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and this is a big issue, and I know from many other schools that I talk to that particularly where they only handle one stage of school, particularly primary school, a lot of them are concerned that if they do it for their older kids right now, those kids will quickly be going to, say, a comprehensive school or a high school later on, and that what they do in their school will not be aligned with what they do in the next school. And that's really, it's something to be concerned about, and it's great that you're thinking about that, because many schools who want to go one-to-one don't have any power or any even much of a relationship with the schools that they send people to. And certainly, usually in the case of primary schools versus secondary schools, very little influence over those bigger schools as well. So it's an important conversation to have.
Yeah, because, I mean, in some ways, if you're in a situation where the school that your kids are going to in the future is worse off technically than you are, it can be frustrating. You feel like they're in some ways holding you back. But thankfully, yes, all the schools that we are sending our students to do a great job, and I look up to them, and I think they do just an excellent job. And so we are fortunate in that aspect. I always, because that's the example that we always use with Microsoft Office. We have to teach it because they teach it in middle school and high school. Well, then the high schools say, well, they teach it in college and expect you to use Microsoft Word in college. Well, then the colleges say that the businesses require you to use Microsoft Word when you go to work. So it's like this whole conundrum of bad decision, bad decision, bad decision. And so it's nice that in this instance, we're all kind of thinking for the future and thinking what we're doing. Because many of the schools, I know two of the schools we send a lot of students to have dedicated iPad programs where that's the device. One of the schools has a BYOD, and another one of the schools, I believe, has another BYOD, where they obviously iPad is the predominant device.
Yeah.
So our next step in the process was to basically survey our upcoming fifth grade parents. And we had three questions on that survey. Basically, are you planning on sending your child to a school that has some sort of iPad program in sixth grade? And we listed the schools that do. The majority of them said yes. The second question was, would you be in favor of us doing some sort of iPad program? And then the third question is basically your child's gender, mainly just trying to see if we can gather what we can, based on the schools that are all girls schools that might be going to, trying to gather any information. The thing we should have asked and we did not is, if you said no, you wouldn't be in favor, why not? Because it's possible that someone saying no just doesn't understand what we're doing or has concerns that we are thinking about. So.
Yeah. So can you share the numbers that you got, or do you have the survey back yet?
Yes, we are about 70-30 in favor.
Okay.
So
that's,
I think,
interesting. Yep.
It started out like pretty, like a lot of no's, but as time has gone on and everybody has answered, it's definitely tipped in the favor of yes. So that's where we're at right now. My next step in this process in terms of deciding is meeting with the teachers and meeting with our administration to kind of talk through their concerns and work through those before we actually make the final decision. I'm making jots down about different devices we would use, what our deployment is, the apps we would use, and I'll go through some of those in just a minute. But those are things I'm thinking of, kind of in my head now. But my next step in terms of a kind of like public presentation of the program is getting our teachers' buy-in and getting our administration's buy-in, which I think they will be for it. Our teachers in that grade are very receptive to new technology and see its value. So if I had to guess, I'd say we'll do it, but we'll see.
It seems like you're in good shape. I mean, you're seeing 70-30 in favor. I think that's in line with what I've heard in most schools who have gone to the bother of doing a survey, and I think more schools should, to be honest. Even though the surveys shouldn't be binding, because the decision should be the schools at the end of the day, because they're the educational experts. But I have seen, rarely seen below that number, and often seen above it, 80% and 90% in favor. And it just feels to me, and I've kind of been seeing this for a little while in presentations and so on, that if you think about who these parents are, right, time has gone on sufficiently that these parents now of children that age and a bit younger are people who have grown up with the entire internet as part of their life and culture, and certainly their careers, if not their university time, and possibly their school as well. So it's the point I kind of like to make to people is that these are not, the children are not the digital natives anymore. The digital natives are the parents. We actually missed their generation when they were in school, and those are people like me and you, Bradley. Those people who grew up with the first home computers. School essentially just kind of missed them out. And now we're talking about digital natives, and they're actually the children of the people who grew up with computers. So I feel that there's a real appetite amongst parents generally for more modern and more relevant technology in schools. And it's not universal by any means. None of these things ever are. But I think you're starting to see vast majorities in favor rather than 50-50 or even small minorities keen on it and everybody else not. So I think that the winds are changing there for sure.
And I kind of had a moment today where I realized the power of technology in the educational process. My son loves to go to the aquarium here. Chattanooga actually has one of the best aquariums in the country. I think Atlanta's is quite a bit bigger, but Chattanooga's is just fantastic, and it's been here since I was probably 10. So we have a pass to it, and we went today since I was off from work. And he has like a little app that on an iPad that he can play, like learn about the ocean and fishies and stuff. Fish is, I call them fishies because that's what he says. But we walked up to the jellyfish, and again he's three, so we walked up to the jellyfish, and he said, "Daddy, that's a jellyfish." And I thought, how would he know that otherwise? I have not taught him that. My wife has not taught him that. How would he know that that's a jellyfish? I didn't know that when I was three. And,
for sure. Yeah.
And so those are the things that he can learn. And one of my favorite pre-K apps for the iPad is called Endless ABCs. And there's a new one out called Endless Reader where it kind of takes Endless ABCs and adds that model to sentences, and he'll play that. We'll let him play it after dinner for a few months, and he's actually really starting to pick up words and be able to match up the word to where it dragged the word to where it's supposed to go to. It's laying, it's laying over outline, and we didn't have this when we were kids. I don't know what we did. I guess I was playing with G.I. Joes, but I think there's value in him being able to do that, because I couldn't come up with stuff like that on my own with construction paper.
Yeah, that's it's not something that just comes naturally to most parents, I would say.
So 70-30 is where we're at. And we wanted to serve them knowing that it wouldn't be binding, that we would still do what we think is best for the educational process. But I think it's helpful to know where you stand and how much,
yes.
I don't want to say pitching you have to do, but or persuading, but basically a good job of presenting the program and what it's for. Because if you have 20% in favor and 80% against, you're going to need to spend some time in the, you know, in the front part of your deployment talking about what you want to do, the reasons for it, and then what you hope to get from it. But if you've got a 70-30 or 80-20 in favor of, you can spend more time talking about the process of what you're going to do from an operational perspective, rather than, you know, why. And because again, if my son was at a school and they said, "Hey, we're going to do an iPad program. Are you in favor of that?" And they would get a thumbs up from me, like, I like that, and I see value in that. You don't have to pitch me on that. I think you should be doing that. So I think a lot of our parents are getting that way. But again, our generation, we grew up with it. We don't, obviously things are much more advanced now, but we see what is available now to what we had in school. Like I guess I was probably like 18 when we got high speed internet at home, and you can see what that does to what you can do, you know, with technology. And so, like, I see value in what we do, and so I think a lot of our parents are in that same boat where they have lived in the, I don't want to say baby internet, but they didn't always, they're not like, we knew the world like pre-iOS and pre-high-speed internet. We saw what we could do with that, and we see what we can do now post all that.
Yeah, and I think you're starting to see that these kind of parents are keen adopters of technologies like smartphones. I mean, most people are keen adopters of technologies like smartphones if they can possibly afford them. But, you know, it goes a bit further than that, I think. And it seems that, you know, the way I look at the world as a parent is that, well, technology is not optional for my kids. You know, it's something that is not going away. And if it is going away, then we've got bigger problems than just the fact that they don't know Microsoft Office. So that's the way I see it. And I think more and more and more, the schools I go to, people I talk to, they're all saying they're hearing similar things from their parents, that large majorities are in favor of, not necessarily always in favor of the iPad program, but they're in favor of a enhanced technology program that's more personalized, that is more modern than going into a computer lab. And of course they have questions, certainly there's always questions, but my experience as somebody who often goes to other schools and presents on this kind of topic and helps their parents think through it is that the questions I get today are much more about how will it help the learning? How will it help in the classroom? What will you do within the classroom? How does that look? Explain that to me. Show me an example, rather than, surely it'll get broken and it's too expensive, blah, 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 blah. It's, people have sort of realized that, okay, there's a value to this, but what they're really sort of asking is, how do I know that the school, are going to genuinely put this to solid use throughout the education process, and both, you know, when it is appropriate and also when it's not appropriate as well. So it's a very interesting conversation, and to me a much more rewarding conversation to have than just, you know, arguing about whether kids need to be using Microsoft Office or whether you should just get a laptop instead.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that it's more productive to talk about what you can do versus like what you should be doing, in terms of like they got to know Word, you got to know Excel, instead of it, almost dream bigger than that. Let's think of like how do we, because again, I like in high school I learned Microsoft Office 97. What good does that possibly do me today? It does me zero good. And so we should be teaching our kids higher level technology thinking. Adaptability in technology to me is as much as important as anything. Being able to learn, teach kids the process of learning new things, and seeing kids not be taught how to do something but learn on their own just by experimentation. Because then that's how you in the future adjust. Because 15 years from now, I don't know that we'll have like, I don't know what iOS will look like or if it'll be something brand new. But if we teach them troubleshooting skills, problem-solving skills with technology, then they can learn in the future anything that's thrown at them.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know what you think of this, but I agree with all of that. That could also be used as an argument for a bring-your-own-device program rather than an iPad program. Because you could say, well, you know, if adaptability is important, then we should force them to be adaptable all the time. I don't know what you think about that. And, you know, did you think about going BYOD rather than looking towards an iPad program?
No, I just, let me preface that. The students our purchase model will be that the parents will purchase them. Mm-hmm. We will give them guidelines on what we want. I'm thinking right now iPad 4 or iPad Air. I don't really want an iPad 2 hanging around, but I want an iPad 4 or newer, preferably with 32 gigabytes, but obviously we'll probably accept 16 gigabytes. Mm-hmm. But and we will add, they can bring their device, but we set the limits on what they can bring. It's a base. You know, we said this is your baseline. The minimum thing we will accept is an iPad 4. Okay. But again, it goes to the same reason you don't let the students pick the textbooks. You standardize. Mm. And so the teacher, I mean, you can imagine the confusion if every student had a different version of the textbook. Like this student had version 1, this one had version 2, this one had version 3. This one maybe had an entirely different thing, but it was kind of the same concepts. Imagine the confusion that would go in the classroom if the teacher could not prepare knowing what everybody had. That's what you get with a BYOD. When you, again, you get one student with a Kindle, you get one student with an iPad, you get one student with a Surface. It just doesn't work.
I mean, I agree with that, and I think that the studies that have been done in Scotland recently, this message comes out again and again that at least for now, and for now meaning both the current state of development of all the mobile technologies and also the current state of readiness of schools and teachers to do this, that a single platform deployment is preferable to a multi-platform deployment. Now, that's not the same thing as saying iOS all the time everywhere, but what they are saying is that to get started, it's much easier to start with a single platform deployment and then possibly open it up to multi-platform in the future. Whereas, you know, schools that have gone directly down BYOD sometimes find it a little more difficult to go further with it. I think, and this is the thing that I feel like I have seen with BYOD situations, is that it's not that you can't use them. It's not that you can't even get them turned on in the classroom. Of course you can, and you could probably get on the web. But the problem is that it sort of puts an upper bound on what you can do by only sort of being able to do the things everybody can do. And if you don't have that, I feel that at least right now, you're going to struggle, because there are clear distinctions between the platforms in terms of their capability as tools for creativity. And some of them are very, very weak, and some of them are much, much stronger. And to have that level of dynamic range in the classroom where you have some very weak devices and some very strong devices and everything in between, I just don't know that everybody's ready for that right now. And I'm not saying that in the future that might not be possible or even desirable, but I feel like right now, both for the state of mobile technology and the state of teachers and schools and IT departments' readiness for it, that this is the right thing to do for now. That's what I think about it anyway.
Well, I agree. One of the, you know, some of the apps we're looking at are Google Drive, iWork, iMovie, and Explain Everything. Those apps will definitely be in my toolkit. And something like, obviously, Google Drive is on an Android tablet. Is it? I don't believe it's on a Surface tablet. I don't think they make a Google Drive app. And who knows how good the web? And who knows how good the web interface is on the Surface of Google Drive? I know it's pretty terrible on iOS. And again, you know, there is no Explain Everything for the Surface. I mean, that is there an Explain Everything for Android?
I have heard that they are working on it. I don't know if it's available yet, but I've heard it's coming.
So those are the kind of apps that if you do a BYOD, you just don't get access to those. And when I say BYOD, where they can bring any type of device. And so you've got one student using Explain Everything in their presentation and another one using, some presentation app on the Nexus 7 that may not be as good. And so then the teacher's got to help students in both different apps. The teacher has to learn both apps to help the students if they need help. It, to me, it's a bag of hurt, and it's just a mess.
I think one of the things that I don't hear people discussing very much is not just the diversity that you might have, because that's one thing, but the rate of change as well. Because if the device is under the pupil's control of their parents, how often does your set change? So you maybe just learned one set, and suddenly somebody gets a new thing for their birthday, and you've got to figure that one out as well. It's a challenge. Now, I think one thing I'm very interested in as a thought experiment more than an actual thing I'm going to do, but what if every pupil set their own curriculum? and you had a completely individualized education program for each student, then bring your own device is amazing because it can be perfectly tailored to what they want to do in school. But we don't have such a system yet, at least not in most schools. That may be, I may be retired before that world comes, but it would be interesting to see what happened if it did.
Yeah, you often would love to see like a way to tell in the future and to see what the classroom would look like in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and to know, will it look largely the same? And if it doesn't, are the changes drastic or are they slow? You know, it's like when you watch your kids grow up, you don't really see them change, but then you see other people's kids, like, you know, from year to year, and they change dramatically. And, you know, is our education model, is it a slow change or is it a quick change or is it stay the same? I don't know.
Well, I think in general, you know, look, when you look into the future and you do analysis of the future, one of the things that people always do is they overestimate the short term and they massively underestimate the long term. And I think if you were to look at our society, you know, 25 years from now, it will be wildly different from what it is today. But the problem with the tech press and the Apple narrative and everything is everybody wants next year to be radically different from this year. And that happens so rarely in a lifetime that it might as well never happen. This happened a couple of times in our lifetime only. And I think that's the thing that I find interesting is that, you know, if we are planning for 25 years ahead, what does that look like? But one of the big concerns in both in your society and mine, I think, Bradley, is that house prices are such that both parents have to go to work. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the kids have to go somewhere else. Unless we develop a culture of taking your children to work, which, I mean, I take other people's children to work now, so it's a different thing. But, you know, the kids have got to be looked after somewhere. And any educational future that doesn't account for the fact that both parents will probably have to work in most Western societies to afford a house, I think is basically invalid to start with. So that's always something to keep in mind when you think about these things.
Yeah, so we are in that process. We I'd gotten the survey out and I kind of put everything off until after Thanksgiving break. My headmaster was on a mission trip in overseas the week before we were out, so I kind of tabled everything until he got back. And so we will see. We will see where we go. But it's, you know, I was thinking earlier today, if you look at from like 2001 to 2011, how things changed so quickly with technology, with the iPod, the iPhone and the iPad. Because I'm reading the book I'm listening to. It's by a guy named Jay Elliott, and it's called Leading Apple with Steve Jobs. It's basically, this guy was Apple's original HR director. And he did another book called iLeadership about Steve Jobs' leadership style. But this book, it's kind of like in some ways a sequel to that. And it was talking about basically, you know, all Steve did when he got back from Apple. And you wonder if from like 2000 and, you know, we saw from 2001, 2011, we saw those three hit products. From 2011 to 2011, will we see, will technology, I guess, you know, from what we use day to day, drastically change that much again, or will it be slow changes this time around where it's, you know, evolutionary products and not revolutionary?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and I think it seems to me that one of the things that's obviously going to happen is that mobile devices are going to become, if they're not already, the absolutely dominant paradigm for computing for most people in most parts of the world. And I think a sort of retrograde, you know, rear guard action to preserve the status of the traditional computer is, you know, I think just very misguided. I was speaking to somebody on Twitter today who was asking, you know, he was asking for like evidence for the impact of iPads in school. And one of the things I said to him was, look at all the computer studies. Don't just look at iPads, because I think I increasingly reject the notion that iPads are something that you have to study from first principles completely separately from all our previous experience of computers in the school. Now, I think there are some things that are different. You can't be naive about that. So there are clearly some things that are different and new with the iPad, but there are also some things that are continuous. You know, they're still the same. They're connected to the internet. They run software. They are platforms. You have to build on them and maintain them, and there will be platform changes. How do you handle all those things? All those kind of long-term planning principles are still there. But there are some meaningful differences, but they're not completely unknown new things. And I think that's really important to bear in mind as we go forward, that basically what we've done is we've made these little things into computers, phones, tablets, and so on. So it's interesting to see. I think we could go on forever about what we think might happen in the future, but I guess that Moore's Law grinding away on mobile devices is probably the most interesting trajectory that I can see right now. And we've talked about iPad Air already, and I'm not really ready to shut up about it yet, because I'm still blown away every time I pick it up by just how fast and responsive and capable that thing is. And to think that that's going to happen again in another 18 months, it's going to happen again in another 18 months, to me that's fascinating, because what we need now is for software developers to catch up and start using some of that power, and it'll be fascinating to see what they do. But you already see some of those things happening with iPhone 5S, for example, with the camera and some of the signal processing that's happening in the camera, and some of the slow motion processing and things like that. And to see that start to roll into some more and more software that can take advantage of that power and also do more with it. I've already seen that over 3 years, and I think we'll see it again happening at some time over the future.
Yeah, I agree. It'll be fun to watch.
Let's hear it from Moore's Law. Do you want to take another sponsor break?
Yeah, let's do that. I want to thank the fine folks at Jamp Software. And I'll say, on Twitter, like if you follow a company, it can either be awesome or it can be terrible, depending on how they handle their Twitter account. And if you don't follow Jamp Software on Twitter, I highly recommend that. They are a good company to follow. They have a good mix of customer testimonials, stuff about their products and contests and other things. So it's at Jamf Software, JAMF Software on Twitter. So definitely follow them. But they provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology in the education environment. This includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs. Now, again, when iOS 7 came out, they had same-day support for iOS 7. So that's the kind of company you want to be doing business with. We've said for months now that in a one-to-one program, MDM is just really a core competency, and you've got to pick the right vendor. So they also have a great tool called Casper Focus that places powerful technologies directly into the hands of teachers that work with students every day. Casper Focus allows the teacher, not the IT staff, to quickly gain students' attention, to conduct secure exams. They can select specific Apple TVs assigned to their class. They can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. So again, if you're looking for mobile device management software for your school or business, definitely check them out. We'll have a link to their website in the show notes, or it's jamfsoftware.com. And we've heard from listeners that have done some demos with them, and they absolutely love them. So definitely check them out. Thanks for Jamp Software for sponsoring the show this week.
Love me some Casper Suite. I'm still getting email floods from when I figured out how to turn on the notifications. It just hasn't stopped. But it's actually been really useful, because one of the things that one of the ways I set up smart groups in my Jamf, my Casper Suite, is I have ones, for example, I have a smart group for all devices whose storage usage is below 25%. Then I've got another one for all devices between 25 and 50%, 50 to 75%, and then more than 75%. And each of those groups will email me whenever a device is added to or removed from one of those groups. So what I get two emails now every time somebody goes over the 25% threshold, the 50% threshold, the 75% threshold, and so on. I also have another one. This is quite a cool trick. Is because our kids have control of their own OS updates, not all of them are on the very latest version. So what I have is I have one smart group which says not on latest version, and it's, OS version is not whatever the current version is. And every time Apple releases a point update, I just change the criteria to be the latest version. So what I get now is every time somebody upgrades their iOS to the current version, I get an email saying this device has gone out of the not in current version group. So it's been really useful to just get those alerts and see how the devices are sort of changing in the deployment without me having to necessarily go and poke around and find out about it. So there's some cool tricks there. And maybe in a later show, we'll talk through some more of the ways that we can set up those groups and some of the other things that we can do with it too.
You have the awkward conversation with a student. It's like, all right, son, you're on the original version of iOS 7. 7.1.5 is out. We've got to upgrade you today. It's done.
There's there's a one girl in the school who's she's been off for a while, and she's the only person left on iOS 6. There's one person left in iOS 6, because I've not seen her iPad since, so I haven't helped her upgrade it. But I think she's going to be back soon. So
go to her house. Can I have your iPad for a half hour? I'll take care of this. It would be nice to control, and this is an Apple thing, not a MDM thing, but when that process could happen. It would be cool, somehow through the caching server, if you could say, don't let students download this OS yet, from my network, or somehow, kind of block that OS update just until you get certified it somehow. I don't know.
An interesting topic, because I had this conversation in South Africa with a number of school admins in Cape Town, because many schools in South Africa are very constrained for bandwidth, so they were concerned not particularly about the capabilities or the bugs or anything like that. They were more concerned that it was just going to ruin their networks and their data caps for the month. So they were asking, how do you prevent this from happening? And I said, well, Apple doesn't really provide a switch for it. But what they had sort of figured out themselves was they could filter the Apple software update server on their firewall, so that none of the devices could reach the update server to even check for one, because all their devices were staying in school overnight. If they took it home, that's a different matter. And that's why I wasn't particularly concerned, because I knew that if for all my kids who took their devices home, they could just press a button and they would do it. I've been surprised, actually, how few kids actually do press that button now that it is completely under their control. I thought I would see a lot more kids keeping very up to date with the latest version. And I'm not really seeing that as much as I thought. There's quite a substantial number of kids in the school who are not on the very latest point release of iOS. So I think I agree with you, Bradley. It would be interesting to have some more control over that. And I think the control I want is actually not blocking it as much as pressing a button in my MDM that says make everybody update to iOS 7.05 right now, and just move everybody in one go, wherever they may be on a network. If I can push to them, I can make them update. That would be pretty good fun.
Like your face came up and said, Fraser wants you to update or not.
Uncle course, Sam wants you to run iOS 7.05.
In those schools in South Africa, that's where the caching server would come in really handy, now that it can do iOS, because they can download it one time and then serve it out locally.
Yeah, that's going to be a huge win for schools like that, for sure. I hope they put them in Apple stores as well, for all those people restoring their new phones from the Genius Bar.
Yes, I'm sure that would be handy. And I wouldn't think it'd be too much. I mean, they could just, even on just a Mac Mini or something in the back, just you just turn on, just hit a switch and you're off and running. It doesn't have to be a particularly powerful machine, just enough that can hold, especially since, you've probably got, handful of SKUs that they've got to have devices downloaded for. So it probably wouldn't be too bad.
So we will talk more about that next week, I think. We're going to have a guest on the show who has analyzed caching server in a bunch more detail, and we will get into all the nitty-gritty about that next week. All right. I'll tell you my topic.
Yes.
The war is over. And by the war, I mean the Apple-Google war. This is something I was blogging about and tweeting about over the course of the week. I eventually wrote it up on the blog. But it just occurred to me, I can't remember what it was I was doing. I think it was Ian Bettridge, who's a journalist in the UK. He was tweeting about when the Google Play Music app has just been released for iOS. Only for the phone, actually. There's not an iPad version. But I had a look at it. I mean, I'm not a Google Play Music user. I just use iTunes Match. But I use plenty of other Google services, and I had previously been experimenting with the Google Search app again, which has been on iOS for ages, but has recently basically got the capabilities of Google Now. So you can get the cards, it tracks your location, it can give you information about flights and different things. It's really, really pretty cool. And I just got to kind of thinking about this and realizing that sort of silently, without anybody kind of noticing, Apple and Google have kind of got back together a little bit. I thought it was quite interesting to just kind of go through it and actually look at how many Google properties are on iOS. Because if you think about it, back in 2007, I rewatched this part of the video this morning just to kind of prepare for the show. And if you watch the 2007 iPhone introduction, there's a bit where Eric Schmidt comes on stage and makes a quite sort of toe-curling suggestion that they merge apple and goo and call it apple goo, which I think is probably the worst company name that has ever been invented on the spot.
So, Steve, you know, I've had the privilege of joining the board, and there's a lot of relationships between the boards. And I thought, you know, if we just sort of merge the companies, we could call them apple goo. But I'm not a marketing guy.
Apart from that, he kind of goes on and says, look, Google is all about data and services and protocols, and Apple's all about hardware, and we are really great at this, and Apple's really great at that, and look what we can do when you put it together. And they were talking specifically about maps and email and Google search at the time, but there's obviously many new properties since then. And then things went bad, right? Things went wrong for a long time. And, you know, Steve Jobs famously was quoted as saying he wanted to go thermonuclear war on Android because it was a stolen product, end quote, on the basis that Schmidt had been on Apple's board during the development of the iPhone and had obviously taken a lot of those ideas and applied them to Android. And, you know, there have been some rough times. I mean, iOS 6, the Maps thing, various other bits and pieces of Apple getting away from Google or competing with it on things like Siri. It's been, you know, the war got acrimonious for a while, do you not think?
Yes. And, you know, going back to that thermonuclear comment, I think I mentioned it on the show last week, but the book by, I think Fred Fogelstein is his name, the Wired writer, book called Dogfight, about how basically how the war happened and kind of the ramifications, and has some great insight and some great interviews. So if you're wanting to know more about kind of that breakup, definitely check out that book. It's I think it's on Kindle and iBooks and on Audible.
That was definitely on my Christmas reading list, I think. But I mean, the insight, the credit for this insight really is not to me, but it's to Ben Baharin and Benedict Evans, who are two analysts who do an amazing podcast that I love called Cubed, which is a brilliant podcast just talking about the state of the mobile industry and computer industry and so on. But I think it was Benedict Evans who pointed out that basically what has happened is that Apple and Google have both won the war, but they've won it in different ways because they were actually fighting for different things. And what Apple has been fighting for, one, is the ability to sell phones for a very good margin, iPads for a good margin, and get people to come back and buy them again and again and again. I was talking about this in class today with a class that I was teaching. We were looking at Apple and Google and Amazon and Facebook, and we were saying, well, what do each of these companies want? And in fact, they all want a different thing. Google wants to track your behavior. They want to gather data about what you're interested in and what you do. They want to know information about you so they can feed Google Now to tell you more things and so on and so on. And Apple wants to sell you a device. And in many ways, Google has realized that, in fact, the people who buy iOS are incredibly valuable people to have data about. Because as many of the metrics that are tracked show, people who use iPhones and iPads use them more for more things, spending more money through them, and using them on the web much more than the typical Android user, for example. And that what's happened is that Google has basically brought all their services onto iOS. And I made a list of them on my blog, and let me just read it out to you, Bradley, just to give you an idea of what's there. And while I read this, try and think of any Google products that are not part of this list. So we get Gmail. Gmail app is amazing on iOS. It's just gotten so much better than it was in its first iterations. We've got Google Chrome. Now, okay, it doesn't run the Chrome rendering engine. That's Apple's security decision. But you have the Chrome interface and you have the syncing infrastructure and so on with other instances of Chrome that you might run. The YouTube app, which has replaced the iOS 5, a native YouTube app, is way better than that app ever was. Now, young Beth, my middle daughter, is furious about this because she's quite unhappy that the adverts now can't always be skipped, which is obviously one of the reasons why, you know, the YouTube thing happened and came off iOS and iOS 6 was because Google wanted to run ads in it, Apple didn't want them running ads in a built-in application, blah, 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 blah. So we are where we are now. obviously Google Now is part of the Google Search application, so you've got voice search basically everywhere in all these applications, but also Google Now can pop up. And I noticed there was just an update for the Google Search app today, which provides you with push notifications for stuff that you've reminded yourself about in Google Now and so on. So there's increasing integration with Google Now on iOS. Obviously, Google Maps coming to iOS was a major resolution of a fight. Okay, that was in some ways, that's the iconic fight between Apple and Google, was over Maps. And of course, Apple Maps has its problems, but it also isn't as bad as people say it is. Whereas Google Maps is now on iOS, it's on the phone, it's on the tablet, and it's a really great app. Tons and tons of really good data on it. Google Earth, it has been on iOS for quite a long time, still there. Obviously, we've talked a lot, Bradley, about Google Drive, not just this week, but on previous shows, how that's come along in such a long way on iOS. Still a ways to go with that, and particularly in terms of editing the word processing documents from Google Drive, but it's become a really, really great iOS citizen. Obviously, I mentioned Google Play Music is available now. Google Plus, for those who use it, is on iOS. It has a pretty good phone and tablet app. We've got Google Hangouts, which I think is perhaps maybe the weakest of them all. It's not that polished, and it's nothing like as good as FaceTime, for example, but it's there, and as we know, Google will get better with all of these things. We've got Blogger, there's an app for controlling your Chromecast device, there's Google Translate. Is there anything else Google does that we don't have on there?
There is no dedicated calendar app.
That's one, for sure. There's no dedicated calendar app. There's no dedicated contacts app either. But that, you could see how that might become a feature of the Gmail app in future. And I think the only other one I can think about is Google Voice, which is not really an international Google product. I don't think it's even available in the UK. So I'm not sure that really qualifies as a top-tier Google product anymore. But it seems to me that that's pretty much the full suite of Google apps.
Well, no, there is a Google iOS. There is a Google Voice app.
Oh, maybe I just didn't see it because I was looking at the UK.
Yeah, store. It's remember that was famously the app that was being held in review for like 2 years.
Oh yes, I remember.
And then now there's a slew of third party Google Voice apps as well, but I think those are going to be getting cut off at some point in the near future. But the Google Voice app is terrible. I've not used it. I used it the other day for something, and it's absolutely terrible. It just hasn't been updated for iOS 7. It's got terrible reviews on the website, but from what I can tell, this Google Voice is kind of getting merged into Google Hangouts. So,
That's what I was going to say. Yeah,
it's probably just, and I don't think like they're taking away the ability to like kind of have your own phone number with a local area code. Because I use my Google Voice number as kind of like my spam phone number when I know I'm going to get spammed for something when I give them my phone number. That's what I give them, then it calls me, and I can tell that it's my Google Voice number calling when it forwards to me. But so I don't think they're taking that feature away, but I think it's just basically being merged into Hangouts. So I'm sure they're just kind of setting on Google Voice the current app until all that functionality has been added.
Yeah, it definitely seems that that's the way that Voice is going, because Hangouts is a much more international product as well than Google Voice ever was. But yeah, the point of all of this, I think, is to suggest that there's nothing I can see there that Google is really holding back for Android exclusivity. There was a news story came out this week that the Android 4.4 doesn't include Chrome. And in order to get Chrome, you now have to sign a license with Google, the same license that you would have to sign to get, for example, Maps on your Android phones you're going to ship, or Gmail on the Android phones you're going to ship, and so on. That more and more of these premium parts of the Google experience are not a built-in part of Android. They're now part of this additional set of licenses that you have to sign with Google in order to be able to ship these products with your Android-based device.
Are these licenses like financial based, or they you must give us your data based?
I don't know the details of any of them, but I would guess there's probably a bit of both. There's probably a fee involved, and there's probably some. I guess what you get is you get those apps, and those apps have their own privacy policy that goes along with them. So whatever signals come through those apps, Google can get. And that's fine. I mean, that's part of the deal, right? I don't think people are unconscious of the fact that the reason you get a lot of Google searches for free is because that data and activity has value to Google after the fact. But what's really interesting about that is if you look at it that way, then not only are Google doing that to Android OEMs, but they're also providing that same service, okay, different apps, but the similar service to iOS. And now, one of the historic reasons for buying Android was because people would often say to me, I don't know, you probably heard this argument as well, Bradley, that, well, I use all the Google services, so I should get an Android device because it works better with the Google services. And I think that's probably never been less true. That it's, I'm not saying it's not, there's not a degree of greater integration on Android phones, but what I'm saying is that it's not like you are being, as an iOS user, are being cut out of some premium Android experience that, you know, Google service experience that you could only get on Android. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that, I find that really interesting, and I think that it kind of benefits both parties, right? Because Apple has the high-value customers. They have the most active customers. They have the most engaged customers. And Google is providing their services to those customers as well as to the people notionally their own platform as well. So I just thought it was interesting to note and worth taking a moment to reflect on that. You now, as an iOS user, you've now got the best of both worlds, really. You've got all the Apple services very well integrated, and you've got access, in some cases very good access, through push notifications and so on, to many of these Google services as well. I'm not saying they are as good on iOS as they are on Android, but they are all there, and they are all getting dramatically better in quite short order. And in particular, you know, just wanted to highlight Gmail, which I've started using exclusively on both my phone and my iPad. Now, when the Gmail app first came out on iOS, it was terrible. And, I mean, this is how bad it was, is that in the Compose window, I could out-type the Compose window on my phone keyboard. And that's how slow it was. You know, you'd type, 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 and then wait a second, and then it would fill in what you were typing. I think, in fact, what that was it was a web page embedded in the app, and I think now they've moved to some kind of native editing interface for that, and it's much the better for it. But my point is that all of these apps are just sort of rolling forward, almost in the way Apple rolls their products forward year on year on year to get better and better and better, to the point where they are a pretty powerful suite of tools for some of the things that you might want to do with online services. What's your preferred Maps app, Bradley? Are you a Apple Maps guy?
I am, but I'll tell you my main frustration with it, and it's not really Apple's fault, it's Google's. I don't know why I do this. Like, a lot of times I will search for something on Google, and I will want to click on the address, and I want it to launch, especially like if I'm about to pull out of the driveway trying to get directions. When I click on that address, it launches either the Google Maps app or the WebView, because I don't even think I have the Google Maps app installed. So, but I understand why
they wouldn't route you to Apple Maps.
Exactly. And I understand that because I'm on Google.com. So maybe I should like switch to Bing or to Yahoo and see if like addresses work differently there and can throw me to the actual Maps app. Or probably the thing I should do is like actually search on the Maps app for what I'm looking for. That probably would be a better way to do it if it could find it.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, that's the absolute weakest part of the Apple Maps experience, is searching for points of interest. If you have the destination address correct, then I usually find it's okay. But searching for, you know, the name of a school that I'm going to or something, it's just terrible for that. So we were actually using the Google Maps app in school this week because we were doing a bit of work with designing itineraries as part of an administrative task. And it was just kind of amazing to me, like, what you could do in that application. You know, the amount of detail and the amount of data you could get was just mind-blowing. And I'm just really impressed. I mean, this is, I guess, a story that's kind of gone on over the past few shows, is just how impressed I am with Google products on iOS, that they're getting really, really, really good. And it will be interesting to see, because here's my question for the future, right? What does it benefit Apple to prevent users from setting any of these apps as their defaults? If I want to use Gmail as my default mail application, if I want to use Chrome as my default browser, what does Apple really lose? If you think about Apple's business model, Apple wants me to buy a new iPad or a phone. How does it hurt Apple if I want to use the Gmail app on the on my Apple phone or my Apple tablet? I don't know that it does.
No, I mean, as long as you are not, I guess, swayed to move over to Android when your contract's up, then you know, Apple wins when you buy devices. Amazon wins when you buy stuff from their store, and Google wins when you use their services. And if on iOS, like everybody can win. Amazon can win, Google can win, and Apple can win. And that's the only platform where that all can happen, where everybody can win. And that, in some ways, is what makes me sad about, like, when reading that or listening to that book about the battle. And you see a lot of the employees felt that way as well. You know, it wasn't like that Google or Apple had to lose for everybody to win. There's a way they can all, because they're not all competing for the same dollars. Well, you know, now, in some ways, for Apple to lose or for Microsoft to win, Apple has to lose because Microsoft is setting their business model up in such where they want to sell you the entire thing, the hardware and the software. So customers have to choose. You know, and look at the Microsoft experience on iOS. It's abysmal.
Well, I think the reality is that for Microsoft to win, both Apple and Google have to lose simultaneously.
Yes.
And I think the chances of that succeeding is basically nil. I think that's starting to become quite obvious. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the Microsoft experience is nowhere. We've talked about this before. You know, where is Office for iOS? It's nowhere. Why? Because reasons, right? But Google clearly are very smart with this. And I think in many ways, I think this is great to see. I'm delighted to see this because I love some of these services. I love Gmail. I've used it for years and years and years, and you couldn't pry it off out of my hands with a crowbar. But I think the next step is for Apple to recognize that the war is over as well. Because I think Google already have. Clearly, the investment and the talent they've hired to build these applications, because they are very good iOS applications in the main, is a substantial investment. And the next step of recognition is for Apple to say, well, okay, we're going to allow you to replace the mail application. We're going to allow you to replace the browser and maybe the maps application. And those three, if all you could do was replace the browser, the mail client, and the maps application with their Google equivalents, optionally, under the control of the user, I think we would, iOS would just be, on the road to heaven. I think it would be fantastic.
I just did an experiment, and Bing does not throw me to the Maps app. It throws me to a mobile Bing Maps, but Yahoo search does throw me, if I hit directions, if I search for my work and it asks for me to, for my location to use it, and I say yes, I get directions and it throws me to the Maps app. So I guess I know what I'm replacing Gmail with on or Google with on my phone for default search. For me, it's interesting because my personal stuff is iCloud Mail, and so I've always used the Mail app, and it's worked fine. One of the things I would love to see Apple do, and maybe they don't, and maybe the solution is to allow changing of the default browser, is to start building some sort of extension program for Safari on iOS. And you alluded to this on Twitter this week, and you're using the iCab browser, which is part of our process for uploading, and they have these various modules that you can plug in. And it made me kind of realize how really limited Safari on iOS is. It's really fast and it's really stable. But as far as, kind of doing more with it and taking it and using that things with other apps, it is very limited. I mean, I have the Dolphin browser installed only to use the Evernote Clipper.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, I think, in many ways we're so spoiled because the fact that Safari exists at all in iOS and does what it does is amazing. And it's important not to forget where we've come from on that. But I agree that, I guess you and I and people like us are absolutely on the leading edge of demanding use for iOS, right? And I think, a couple of years from now, there's going to be, the early adopters are going to be in. I mean, we're the very early adopters. We're the vanguard, if you like. And then the early majority and then the late majority. And once we're kind of on that hump of people wanting to use additional things in Safari or whatever, then the design and the ideas are there. There's a cryptographically signed extension system for Safari on the Mac, and that could all be brought over to iOS, I think, without I mean, this is a classic trap to say without much difficulty. I mean, obviously there's going to be engineering involved, but Apple's an engineering company and they could certainly allocate the resources to that if they wanted to. I think it's fascinating times. And in many ways, this is like the next step along the road of these platforms maturing, is to realize that things like replacing parts of the default system and allowing greater inter-application integration, things we've talked about before in the show as the things we want from iOS 8 and 9 and further on down the road, I think the time is coming for a lot of those things. I certainly hope it is. Obviously, in keeping with the requirements for security and stability and things that we've come to love about iOS, not giving them up. But one can see that there's a world coming where, you know, mummy and daddy are not fighting anymore, if you like, and all these Google services that are starting to get really good in iOS can become a little bit more integrated. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that Apple will ever allow Siri, a major flagship feature, to be replaced by Google Now, but, you know, you can see a world coming where that might be more Tim Cook's Apple and Steve Jobs' Apple, perhaps.
The thing that,
maybe they recognize that war is over.
The thing that showed me, I guess, gave me great promise for the future of iOS becoming the new macOS in some ways, like the you know, kind of the power platform, is background app refresh, something that I never thought we would see on iOS.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a real interesting example, because that's if you do that in a naive fashion, you end up basically having to have an iOS task killer somewhere, because, you know, you're going to get that wrong. Developers are going to get that wrong at some point. But I have not noticed, and I don't know if you've noticed, but I have not noticed any detriment to my battery life on iOS since iOS 7 because of that feature. And I have never once thought to go in and turn something off because it was going haywire. I just haven't seen that happen yet. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach these other challenges as time goes on. But I think approach them they must. And in many ways, the ball's back in Apple's court in this. Google's made a move. You know, they've put some of their arms beyond use, if you want. They will allow me to use that kind of terminology. And now it's up to Apple to say, well, okay, those apps are pretty good. And wouldn't it benefit our platform to have very good integrated access with that for the people who want Gmail or Chrome or Google Now or Drive or whatever? And I think it'll be interesting to see whether or not they actually, Apple will take that step towards peace as well. I'm using very militaristic metaphors tonight, I'm not sure why, but I mean, thermonuclear war was pretty militaristic to start with, so I'm only continuing the metaphor with conventional weapons, I suppose.
Well, as we've said, the war is over. But I think the thing I've learned from this conversation the most is thinking about Microsoft, and for them to win, almost everybody else has to lose.
Yeah. And that's classic Microsoft thinking, isn't it? You know, it's our way or the highway, right? And in some ways, that's just not kind of the way the world works anymore. I mean, you look at it in so many different aspects of this mobile world, is that there's not one service that's winning. You know, there's so many of these sort of over-the-top messaging applications and so on, different social networks. I mean, Facebook isn't winning mobile either. You know, it's not like the big giants of the PC era have just been able to step onto mobile and win. It's not that settled just yet, and I think it's interesting to see how that's going to work out over the longer term.
Yeah, because even Apple has learned how to make partnerships. You know, there is no Apple Sports. They use Yahoo Sports when they're, you know, kind of pulling that. They use Yahoo.
Use TomTom data for the maps.
Yeah, Yahoo Weather. And they've learned to do, you know, they use Yelp. They've learned how to do things that they do well, and then learned how to make strategic partnerships elsewhere, where Microsoft would just assume start Microsoft Sports or Microsoft, you know, Places or whatever it is.
Yeah, we'll just buy something and rebrand their product. Not to say Apple hasn't done that with things like Siri as well, but I think one of the key differentiators for Apple, I think, is customer privacy, right? And I understand the thinking behind getting the Google products out of the built-in applications because of Google's desire for access to a lot of identifying user data. And Apple, as you can see with some of the sort of NSA stuff that came out over the summer, Apple's made a big play of, you know, our business doesn't depend on accessing customer data. We have no interest in decrypting your iMessages or whatever. Not the same thing as having no capability, but we'll put that to one side for now. And I think that's a differentiator that Apple can play on. But obviously, you know, people who choose to use Google services do so, and certainly after this summer, I don't think they can say they do it without some understanding of the consequences of that, both, you know, in terms of government surveillance, but also just in terms of customer privacy and so on. And that's a trade-off that some people might be willing to make, and let's face it, millions of people are absolutely willing to make. And I think it's really important for Apple to recognize that, that some element of controlled choice is important. I don't necessarily buy the argument that customers have to be able to change every single thing on the platform. The amount of time Android people seem to spend changing their keyboard is bizarre to me. I mean, you decide that once and just get on with it, I suppose. But, you know, at these high-level important key features, if I want to use the Gmail app all the time for everything, I think I should be able to do that.
It's like Apple saying, look, you know, let's take smoking, for example. And I don't smoke, but let's just take smoking, for example. You know, at a public school, they don't allow smoking, but they don't say you can't smoke at home. So, look, you just can't smoke here. And what Apple's saying is, look, we care about customer privacy. You can't have your stuff built in and then track our users. If you want to build an app and put it in the App Store and users want to sign in to your services and let you be tracked, then that's fine. That's their decision. You know, and that's the decision Apple's made. It's like, look, you can't smoke here, but you can smoke elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think it's time for them to be a bit happier about people smoking elsewhere.
Yeah, because they're still using Apple-branded lighters.
Apple still sells the tobacco, right? Or maybe just the nicotine. I don't know. We're so addicted to these things. But yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's interesting, and I think it's fresh. And I think the attitude to it feels a wee bit more... I think cooler heads may have prevailed at the top of these companies now. I mean, Eric Schmidt's no longer running Google in the way he was a few years ago. Steve Jobs is obviously not running Apple anymore. And I think there's maybe some time for some fresh thinking now. I certainly hope so.
I agree.
All right, let's leave it there for this week. We're going to talk caching server next week, and then we're going to try, if we can get all the cables in the right place, we're going to try talking about building a podcast on iOS, and that will be our last show of the season.
Yes, and so if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm Bradley Chambers, and I'm at chambersdaily.com on the web.
I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, and we will catch you next week.
Thanks, guys.